1 Peter 2, 11-17, the fifth talk in a series on 1 Peter, was presented by Ron Julian on August 2, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Now we're in 1 Peter again. We're starting a new section, really, in 1 Peter. He's moving on to a different kind of topic. So I'd like to start out by pulling together what we have seen so far. I would kind of like to, very much in my own words, summarize what I think Peter has been doing up till now. He's been working to inspire us with the big picture, I think, and it's good to remind ourselves what that big picture is. And this will also be helpful to us as we move on to the next section, because it really is the foundation for what he's going to go on to say. Now, notice I say that he's inspiring us. Of course, it wasn't specifically written to us, but I think the nature of his big picture is based on the work that Christ has done in gathering together a people, and as Christians, then we share basically in the same argument that he's making to the people that he's writing to. Our circumstances may be different, but the fundamental picture of our hope and the situation that we find ourselves in life is basically the same as theirs. Okay, so here's how I understand what's been happening up to this point. We have to understand that in many ways the Christian life, living as a Christian believer, is a challenging one. As believers, we did not see Jesus ourselves. We depend on the testimony of people like Peter, who did see him. We live our day-to-day lives without seeing him still. And the great promise of our inheritance in the gospel is still waiting to be fulfilled. So we didn't see him. Life goes on as usual. And the thing that we're supposed to fix our hope on is something that we can't even see in the future. Meanwhile, we live in a world where most of the people around us don't see the world the way we do and may even hate us because of it. And God seems determined to take us through difficult times just so our understanding of life might grow clearer. So we're faced with this situation. We have to make very difficult and fundamental decisions about our lives, about how we're going to live. And on what basis are we going to make these decisions? On the basis of a story, on what others have told us is true about what Jesus did in the past and what he's going to do in the future. So is that enough to base the fundamental decisions of my life on? Can I change my entire way of thinking and living based on a story about what Jesus did in the past and what he will do in the future? Well, Peter, obviously, is deeply convinced that the gospel is enough. What it says happened did happen, and what it promises will come about. And therefore, my picture of the world that I live in now must change. What is this story? The gospel is the good news about the work of Jesus, the Messiah. All of mankind is guilty and lost, but Christ came to call out of mankind a group of people to be rescued. Rescued from guilt, rescued from condemnation, death, sin, futility, all of that. Now, because of our rebellion, we need to be reconciled to God. That's why Peter keeps emphasizing the blood of Christ, Christ's death, which brought about our deliverance. He bought us with his blood. And because of Christ's death, we have received the mercy of God. Furthermore, because we had hearts that were rebellious and dull and hardened against God, God's Spirit needed to make our hearts new. We are actually learning to trust God, to repent of our sins, believe the gospel, and so on. And this is such a profound change that it can be called a new birth. And in the future, our rescue will be completed. Evil and death will be defeated forever. This is our great inheritance, which we should set our hope on completely. So basically, there are these three things that we know and believe if we embrace the story of the gospel. We believe that Christ has called us as a people to have mercy, spiritual rebirth, and the hope of ultimate redemption. As Christians in this age, we are privileged to understand these promises better even than the prophets did. We live in the time when Christ has revealed himself fully, and we are the ones who benefit. So, what are our lives all about now, then? Having embraced that story, what are we supposed to do? Well, life in this age, today, is the time where we have to make the big choices about what our lives are going to be about. As Peter says, many in the world have stumbled over Christ, rejecting and finding no use for him. But for us, now is the time to embrace and live out the implications of this story. Peter makes it clear, as most of the authors in the New Testament do, that God intends to put us through trials that test and refine our faith. And he highlights three areas in which the gospel has implications for how we ought to live. First of all, just as Israel was, we are called to be God's own people, a people for his own possession. We belong to him. He has rescued us for himself. It's as if we're all priests, each of us offering up our own lives, metaphorically, as sacrifices to God. The God who owns us is morally pure and different from the world around us, and we are called as his people to be like him. Secondly, just as Israel was, we are called to be a community of faith. As Christ's people, we belong not only to Christ, but to each other. Each of us has received the same mercy, the same Holy Spirit, the same inheritance. We are called to love each other, to value and serve each other as God's people. Third, just as Israel was, we are called to represent God to the nations. We should be prepared for rejection, just as Christ was rejected, and yet we are called to proclaim the excellencies of the God who has saved us. We are to show the world around us what it means to live under the grace of God. So, this is, I'm sort of pulling together and summarizing what I think Peter has been saying, but this is basically our situation. Christ has called together a people, and as Christ's people, we have been given three things: forgiveness, spiritual rebirth, and a great hope. And as Christ's people, we are called to do three things: to serve and emulate the God to whom we belong, to love our fellow believers, and to reflect God to the world around us by patiently living out our faith. That, I think, in essence, is what Peter has been trying to get across up till now. And as we'll see today, the next section of Peter's letter emphasizes that third aspect, that is, that idea that we are called upon to reflect to the world around us the God that we serve. How are we going to respond as believers living among unbelievers? That's what much of what Peter has to say from here on is going to be about. So, of those three things, the focus for a while here is definitely going to be this idea, being the people of God in a world either indifferent or hostile to that God. And what are we going to do about that? How are we going to live? So we're starting in verse 11 of chapter 2. Start with verses 11 and 12 of chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, 11 and 12. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and outsiders to abstain from fleshly desires, which wage war against the soul, keeping your conduct among the Gentiles excellent, so that in the very thing which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of seeing the excellent things that you do, glorify God in the day of visitation. Okay, so before we try to put this all together, there are a few concepts I think that it would be good to clarify. First of all, this word fleshly, we might take this to mean bodily and see Peter warning against the desires of the body. Don't give in to the desires of the body. But I don't think this is right. The typical use of this word in the New Testament does not really mean bodily, especially in this kind of context, but it means of my flesh, that is, of my unregenerate human nature. A desire that is fleshly is one that arises from my rebellious, selfish nature, from that part of me that wants what it wants, even if it's wrong. And anyway, it's important that we understand that the New Testament does not teach that the body and its desires are evil. This is a rap that we have gotten because a lot of Christians throughout history have taught that that's true. They thought that the Bible was teaching that. They said that's what the Bible was teaching. But it's just not true. That's not what the Bible taught. Marital sexuality is a good gift of God, for example. Paul says so very explicitly. God created these things to be enjoyed. Food and comfort and pleasure are all seen as good things in the right context. So we don't want to misunderstand and think that somehow the New Testament authors are somehow against the body because it is material or something like that. That is not the issue at all. The other word that we want to talk about here is desires. There are a couple mistakes to avoid as we think about that. Your translation may have lusts, and that can sound to our ears as if sexual desire is the issue. If we think of him as saying bodily lusts, then we get a pretty clear picture, we think, of what it is that he's warning against. Again, that's not the typical way this word is used. It can be used that way, but it often encompasses desires, passions of all sorts. It certainly can include sexual desire, but is usually used in a broader way. And as we're going to see in this context, I think in this context, he clearly has a broader concept than just sexual desire or something like that, that it really is those immoral longings that arise from our sinfulness in all of its manifestations in many ways in the world. So I think that's the kind of thing that he's getting at. And there's another mistake that we don't want to make here. This is an easy one. I see people fall into this all the time when the word desire shows up. And the mistake is to think that somehow desire itself is an evil thing. But we are created by God as creatures filled with desires. Our bodies are designed that they have all sorts of desires. Our emotional makeup is such that we have all sorts of desires. We desire love and security and sexual fulfillment and food and shelter and freedom from pain and many other things. And there's nothing wrong with wanting those things. We are called to a very high standard of morality in the way we conduct ourselves, but sometimes we beat ourselves up for the very fact that we have desires at all. And that's not true. That's not the way to think about it. It is the combination that he's talking about here that's deadly. Passions and desires driven by our selfish, unregenerate human nature. Desires that will not back down in the face of what is right and good. The godly person will say no to desires that cannot be fulfilled without committing evil. Sex is not evil, but adultery is evil. The desire to be respected by others is not evil, but the lust for fame and power is, and so on. So, what Peter is getting at here is that we look squarely into those desires that need to be said no to because they are fueled by our own selfishness. That they would lead us to do things that are unloving, unkind, disobedient, and so forth. That's the kind of thing that he's talking about. He says that these fleshly desires wage war on our souls. And I feel like I probably don't need to explain this to you if you're anything like me. There really is nothing so sweet as being at peace in your own soul, to be single-minded in wanting what is good, to look at the choices that I have made and be satisfied and say, yes, I like the direction that my life is going. And yet, that's so often our souls feel more like battlegrounds. At least my soul feels like a battleground. I have taken friendly fire. I have inflicted the damage on myself. On the one hand, it's the most natural thing in the world just to give in to what I want. I mean, we just have that sense. I want it. Why shouldn't I go for it? And yet Peter is urging us to stop and think, what good has giving in to evil desires ever done for our souls? It's as if we're waging war on ourselves. So that's the picture here. That's what he's warning us against. But we want to see in verses 11 and 12 that he's making this admonition in a particular context. The issue in this section is not really just don't give in to evil desires. There is another issue that's at stake, really, that is a part of. Notice that he urges them as sojourners and outsiders, aliens and strangers, not to give in to these desires. And he speaks of keeping their conduct excellent among the Gentiles. What Peter is really concerned with in the section that we're entering into here is the mutual effect that believers and unbelievers have on each other. On the one hand, Peter sees them as people who have converted, who have stepped away from the way of life that they used to be living, but they're living in a culture that still embraces the things that now they have walked away from. So he wants them to remember that in a very real sense, they're strangers, they're sojourners. They don't really live there anymore. They have been called to a new way of living. And on the other hand, he wants them to remember that their conduct affects the people around them as well. Their Gentile neighbors, many of them have a contempt for them, seeing Christians as a kind of evildoer. And yet Peter wants their conduct to reflect God to their neighbors with the possibility of something truly redemptive coming from it. That's what he's going to be exploring in the coming verses, is this idea of a believer living among unbelievers. What choice am I going to make as I respond to the sometimes hostility that comes at me? Now, let me clarify a couple of things here. Peter speaks of their conduct among the Gentiles. Does that mean that his audience is Jews? I don't think that that's necessarily the case. Right now I'm inclined to think that's not how he's picturing them. The New Testament sometimes tells Gentiles to behave themselves among the Gentiles. The word means the nations, and it can easily mean something like the world, especially for a Jewish writer. Living among the Gentiles can, in essence, mean living in the world, living in hostile territory. The Gentiles, the nations, is a very common way for the Bible to refer to the mass of humanity. Okay, and then there's a strange little phrase. Peter tells them to keep their conduct excellent so that the Gentiles might glorify God in the day of visitation. What is that? What is that talking about? Well, up to a point, it's clear enough what he's doing here. This is language that is used in various places in the Bible. The day of visitation, the time of visitation, is this window of opportunity when you are being visited by God in some way. The day of visitation is the time when God has come to make something available to you, or the day of visitation can be a time of judgment when God has stepped in and now you are He is no longer withholding his hand, but he has come and you are paying for what you have been doing. So something, the day of visitation, a time of visitation, is this idea of a time when, as opposed to another time, God has somehow stepped in and is visiting in some way. Jesus told Israel that it did not recognize the time of their visitation. And by that he meant that time that he was there among them. God's Messiah among them was a visitation, an opportunity where God was giving something to them. So what does Peter mean when he says the day of visitation? Some people see this as a future event, like the second coming will be the day of visitation, when Jesus returns, and on that day then perhaps on that day they will glorify God. That's possible. I'm inclined in a different direction. It's not necessarily easy to sort out what Peter means here, but I'm struck by the fact that in this context he's describing the believers as aliens and strangers. They don't really belong there, and yet, for a time, they are being called upon to represent and reflect God to the world around them. So I wouldn't insist on this, but it seems to me the most likely thing is that the day of visitation is this time when the believers are living in the world among unbelievers. God is making himself known to the world through them, because that's what Peter is basically going to be talking about. And his concern is that their excellent conduct be a reflection of God to the world. So maybe not, but that's what makes the most sense to me right now. Okay, so having looked at all that stuff, now we come to this big question. At least it's one for me. I don't know if it is to you. Maybe this sounds perfectly straightforward to you. But I have this immediate sort of reaction to this kind of language when I stop to think about the world that I live in. Do I see the world being the kind of place where Christians are going around converting the world right and left because of their superior virtue? It doesn't pass the laugh test. There are so many holes in that picture that I don't even know how to consider what that might mean. So I want to talk about that. At the end, when we're done with the section we're looking at here, I want to come back to this question. What is Peter picturing? Is this something that makes sense, that we could understand as a reasonable and practical reality in the world? What is he getting at? So, for now, though, like I say, I'll come back to that in a minute. Let's just note that this is, in fact, going to be Peter's theme from now on. As believers in the world, we have the chance to respond to evil with good, and in doing so, perhaps reach out to the people around us. That's what he's going to be talking about. He's going to have three examples here. He's going to talk about how we respond to government authority, how a slave responds to a master, how a wife responds to an unbelieving husband. And we're going to look at the first of those here now. But in each case, the issue is how my response is dependent on ultimately the values that I have and my concern for the other person, the person on the other side. In a way, this is really talking about loving your enemies, is what Peter's going to be talking about here. In verses 13 through 17, Peter gives his first example of what he might be talking about when he talks about living excellently in the midst of their Gentile culture. So 13 through 17, he says, "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the highest authority or to governors as sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For this is the will of God, that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. You do this as free people, and yet not as those using freedom as a covering for evil, but as bondslaves of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood. Fear God, honor the king. Okay, so you've probably been on this territory before, this issue of submitting to the government. It's a tricky issue. What is involved? To what extent are we submitting? I mean, gets to be quite complicated. What we want to do here is try to understand Peter's picture. What is he concerned with? What is it that is the bottom line for him here? We have some clues to that, I think, and we want to take us through this and see if we can sort it out. First of all, I think it's fair for us to bring in some other things that we know about Peter to suggest that Peter would certainly put limits on this idea of the extent and nature of submitting to the king and his governors. We see in the book of Acts that Peter and John are called before the ruling council in Jerusalem and told, "You stop teaching this stuff about Jesus." And Peter and John in Acts 4:19 answered and said to them, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to obey you rather than God, you be the judge." So, in that situation, Peter sees clearly, no, I have been called by God to preach this message. I don't care whether you are the ruling council in Jerusalem, I have to obey God and not you. Doesn't that make sense? He says, you think about it. Would you suggest that I obey you rather than God? So, clearly the submission that Peter speaks of has its limits. Next thing I think that's helpful to remember is that I doubt very much that Peter is naive about the realities that they're facing here. That somehow just, you know, smile and do a couple of nice things and the government's just going to melt and say, oh, you guys are great. The current emperor is Nero. Part of the fiery trials that his readers are going through undoubtedly involves mistreatment by the Gentile governments they are under in one way or another. Peter himself is very close to the day when he will be executed by the Roman government because he is a Christian. He's been told that that day is coming. Peter knows that the government is potentially hostile to Christians and Christian values, and I don't think he's under any illusion that that's just going to disappear if we all behave ourselves. Okay. Next piece of information we've got is that he says this submission is for the Lord's sake and is the will of God. He makes this interesting statement that we are doing these things as free people. We are not really subject to the rule of any human institution, but at the same time, we are bond slaves of God. To the extent that we submit, we do not submit because the king is our master. We submit because God is our master. And that is the way he wants us to behave. But of course, the question is, what is it that God wants us to do? And why does he want us to do it? Okay, well, we have some clue to that in the other things that Peter says here. He says that the goal is to silence the ignorance of foolish men. This is Peter's theme throughout this section. Think about how your conduct reflects the Christ that you serve. How does it impact the perception of unbelievers about what Christianity is all about? Well, what is the problem? What would ignorant men be saying? Peter doesn't say here, but I think we can get something of an idea from other things that we know about what the kind of thing that tended to happen at the time. We see various ups and downs in the history of the relationship between Christians and Jews and the Roman Empire. Both Christians and Jews as being kind of weird, Christians as weird Jews in the eyes of Rome, were perceived as immoral revolutionaries, resisting the public order for their own perverted reasons. I mean, we see Christians being accused of being impious and atheists. They're charged with sedition against the government. They were seen as being the enemy of the proper order and place of the ruling authorities in Rome. Well, there's a sense in which that's not true, and Peter wants them to conduct themselves so that such charges can be diffused. As he says, we are to submit to the king and his governors as those who seek the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. So I think what he wants is he wants us to live in such a way that we are communicating, that we acknowledge that the goal of every government, the promotion of justice, public welfare, the putting down of crime and the support of the citizens of the country, that we are in support of those things. We are not out to subvert those things, but to support them. I think that's what he's getting at. So what does this add up to then? What does Peter want? This is a hard question. I'm not a great political thinker, but this is what makes sense to me right now. Maybe we can talk about it a little bit after and see if you have any ideas as well. What is clear to me is that Peter's concern is the message that we send to our unbelieving neighbors. Christianity really has in it the seeds of revolution and insurrection. As citizens of the kingdom of God, we have no master but God, and every government is imperfect and morally compromised. One might think that Christian discipleship calls us to declare our secession from everything. You have no rights over me. I serve only God. I will not pay your taxes or obey your laws. But the reality is that people very rightly recognize that often such revolutionaries are self-serving. My principles demand that I don't pay taxes and keep all my money for myself. I'm so principled that I will keep every last dime that I ever make. Well, you know, that's convenient principles to have. In Peter's day, I think this is the kind of bad reputation that Christians were getting. They were in it for themselves. They were opposed to the good order of society for their own idiosyncratic and selfish reasons. So I think what Peter is saying is, what's more important here is that your neighbors understand what being a Christian is really all about. This is an opportunity for you to exercise love on behalf of those around you. Whatever freedoms you may feel you have, the fact is you need to conduct yourself in such a way that you're not miscommunicating to them. So, submit yourself to the government as an institution dedicated to promoting the public good. As much as it depends on you, do not give grounds for slandering you as criminals who are opposed to what is good and just. Pay your taxes. Conduct yourself as one who agrees that civil justice is a worthy goal. And then, as we know that Peter would also say, do not obey that government if it asks you to disobey God. Okay, so as I understand it, Peter is not really addressing, for example, the question that Jesus was asked, should I pay taxes to Caesar or not? You know, that sort of thing. He is not taking that question as an abstract question. He's looking at the issue of how do my choices affect the people around me? And so whatever rights I may or may not have, the issue is, what am I going to do as I try to reflect God to the culture around me? I see it as being an example of Paul's be all things to all people kind of language. As a citizen of the kingdom of God, in a certain sense, I have the right to see myself as free from all human institutions. But I am to conduct myself in such a way that I am not misunderstood to be one who hates justice, one who for my own selfish reasons will not obey the rules that everyone else lives by. As much as I can in good conscience, I should live out a life that communicates, I am not exempt from the demands of justice and public order. I submit to the government's right to enforce them. Peter concludes by saying in verse 17, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. I think these are in pairs. We should see them as being paired off. Honor all men, but love the brotherhood. I should honor and respect all men, whether they are believers or not. They should understand in my behavior that I honor and respect them. It's not just have a good attitude towards them, but treat them in an honorable way. And then, yes, it is true, my brothers and sisters, those who are in the community of believers, I am called upon to have a unique love for. But I am called upon to honor everyone in the way I treat them. Likewise, I should fear God, but honor the king. I do not fear the king. God is my master and the only one whose approval really matters. If it comes down to it, I care more what God thinks about me than what any human ruler thinks about me. But the God who is my master has called me to live in a way that reflects him to the world. And so it is his will that I show the respect that is appropriate for a ruler whose responsibility is to enforce justice in the world. I should communicate that I approve of that goal. The goal of all of this is that I not be perceived by unbelievers as their enemy, at least not through any selfishness or lack of love on my part. As much as I can, I should communicate, no, I'm with you in this. I agree that public, the protection of the public from crime, the promotion of justice and so forth, those are goals that I agree with you are things that we ought to pursue and ought to therefore submit to the government that is seeking to promote those things. Okay, so I wanted to stop just with that section for today because there's a lot to think about there. Let's back up here then and think a little bit about this basic principle that Peter is advocating here, because I think it's difficult to get a hold of, and it's slippery and easy to misunderstand, I think. And I feel like I'm beginning to get a little bit of a feel for where he's going, but I do think it's complex. So, like I say, I want to leave plenty of time, and I think I will here today, for us to talk about what the implications of this might be. Basically, he's got this idea, keep your conduct among unbelievers excellent, so that ultimately they might glorify God. And then the first example he gives is the way that we respond to the Gentile government. It's almost embarrassing to say something like this as I look at my own culture. Most of all, I mean, I know I'm always dumping on Christian culture and stuff, but it's just, it deserves it. It's just the way it is. I'm just sorry, but I mean, sometimes I use the language to myself. My wife will tell you that every now and again I wander around the house muttering, I hate Christians. And you really need to understand what I mean when I say that, but there's a lot of ugliness out there in the name of the Christian church. We have a terrible reputation in our culture, and it is not undeserved. I mean, this is the problem. We talk about persecution and the hostility of unbelievers against believers and all that stuff. That's a reality, and we want to talk about that. But in our culture, a lot of the hostility we face is deserved. What can we say? I mean, I've commented on this many times, but there was a song that Bruce Hornsby wrote many years ago where he was talking about watching a televangelist on TV, and when he uses the line, you know, the televangelist is inviting him to convert and send money, and his response is, "Mister, I don't want to be like you." And I just identify with that. Just turn on the TV and watch much of what happens there in the name of Christianity, and my response is, I don't want to be like them. I hope I'm not like them because I don't want to be like them. So we have a terrible reputation in our culture. Much of it is deserved, not all of it. But there's a lot of self-righteousness among us. There is a lot of hypocrisy among us. We have a reputation as being in it for the money, and we have that reputation because a lot of people who are promoting Christian things are in it for the money. I mean, you just can't get away from that. You watch a fundraising thing on one of the Christian TV channels or something where they're promising you that, I mean, these are people who are multimillionaires, who live in the richest sort of luxury imaginable, talking to people who are just barely making it on their paycheck and saying, I promise you, you send me more money than you can afford and God will make you rich. And I'm not exaggerating. That's not a straw man or anything I'm setting up. I've heard it over and over again. Well, I mean, what else can the world around us think when they look at that? But those people are crooks, because they are. I mean, that's what I think. They're crooks. So we can't really say that our excellent conduct is winning over the people of the world, because a lot of our conduct is not so excellent. Well, I think Peter already has an explanation for that. In fact, this is what he's warning us against. Too many so-called Christians are, in fact, pursuing fleshly desires. And here's where we can see that he means more by fleshly desires than just, you know, giving in to sexual temptation or something like that. Self-righteousness is a fleshly desire. It feels great to be better than other people. And religions of all sorts, including Christianity, one of the biggest pitfalls that they have is the temptation to feel better than other people. This is one of the great problems that the Jews fell into. You see, the initial problem of the Jews in the Old Testament was just blowing God off and not taking him seriously. So, after they come back from exile, a party develops that is devoted to purity. We're going to obey God and keep the rules. That's the party that turns into the Pharisees. And now we're on the other side. We have that great God, I thank you that I'm not like other men problem. Well, this is what religion does. I mean, as soon as you find yourself in the spot where you're saying to yourself, I belong to God and others do not, the temptation is to think, and that's because I'm such hot stuff. I really like being one of the elect, because I would have chosen me too if I were God. So in our culture, people have decided, well, there's a way to solve that problem. We can eliminate God, or we can eliminate the idea that there is such a thing as either belonging or not belonging to God. Everybody gets in. Everybody is a child of God. There is no in or out, and that way nobody feels superior to anybody. Well, that is one way to solve the problem, but if the New Testament is right in what it's teaching, that's not the truth. That's not the way it works. So there is, however, this constant temptation, this fleshly desire to think highly of myself at the expense of other people. And it happens all the time. It happens in the church a lot. There are other fleshly desires that we see being pursued by the church around us. The desire for power is a fleshly desire. It is so easy for people who in one way or another end up, say, pursuing a ministry, a Christian ministry, to end up tying their own sense of their own worth and importance to the success of that ministry, and thus ending up building little empires and doing things in such a way that the goal becomes to be getting more people involved or winning. Winning becomes very important. It's the way I can tell that I'm okay. Obviously, the desire for wealth at the expense of principle is a fleshly desire, and obviously that ends up happening a lot in the church as well. So a lot of opposition to Christianity is based on truly ugly behavior that's out there in the name of Christ. A lot of Christian bashing is not persecution, it is just common sense. But not all hostility to Christianity is based on Christian hypocrisy. Some of that hostility is genuine hostility toward God. Because the fact is that not all of the Christianity in the world is hypocrisy. And if there were not one hypocrite to be found in the entire world among Christians, the hostility would still be there. I mean, that's the clear teaching of the New Testament, and that's what Peter thinks. Peter is not suggesting that there is an easy or automatic way to conquer that hostility. All he is saying is that we should live in such a way that we are communicating clearly to unbelievers. The best thing I can do for my neighbor is to sincerely pursue the godly virtues of love, self-sacrifice, kindness, and so forth. It may not do anything, but ultimately it provides a touchstone, something for them to look at and say, you know, there's something going on there. I know that's what happened to me. As an unbeliever, I converted when I was 18 years old, and up to that time in my life, I was incredibly hostile to Christianity, incredibly condescending towards Christians. I thought they were naive and foolish, and they were not paying attention to the evidence in the world. They were just indulging in wishful thinking and so on. And part of the first thing that caught my attention was being among a group of fairly mature Christians who were getting together for these summer barbecues. And I used to go, I'm sure I've told the story before, but I used to go because of the pleasures of feeling superior to them. I would go and listen to them and sit there and congratulate myself for being so much smarter than they were. But the fact is that I started to get a little puzzled. I didn't think about it very much, but I noticed that I kept going back, that there was some reason that I wanted to be there. And the reason that I wanted to be there was something about the lives of the people that I was hanging around with that was different than the other people that I was hanging around with. There was something centered about them, something that gave them a certain gravity, a certain weight, something attractive about that I couldn't quite shake off, although I never articulated it that way. And when they asked me what I thought of them, I told them, and it wasn't pretty. I really was obnoxious. I went for the purpose of showing off what a smart atheist I was. But all I'm saying is there was something there. I couldn't quite shake it off. There was something there. And I think that's what Peter is urging for us, that we basically embrace the implications of the faith, the humility that we're called to have, the compassion that we're called to have, the devotion to God that we are called upon to have, the devotion to each other as believers that we are called upon to have, the respect for all people that we are called upon to have, that in that is something that if somebody's willing to see it for what it is, that they'd have to recognize, yeah, I'm not being fair to those guys. I think this is behind what he's urging as we respond to government. This is really hard, and I honestly wouldn't listen to me necessarily on the subject of politics and stuff. There's a lot to understand there. But it seems to me that part of the church's problem today in the area of how we deal with government is that we're just seen as one more special interest group. Our goal, like everyone else, is political power so we can win, so we can have our own way. And this helps to fuel the idea that Christians are trying to impose their religion on the rest of the country. Now, I think that's an unfair complaint, partially, but only partially, because there is partial truth to it. You just look in the eyes of some of the players out there in the political arena who are on our side as Christians, and you can see that lust for power there, that desire to win, to be the party in control. There's something really satisfying about winning. And I think what Peter is saying to us is that the very best thing that we can do for the world is to live blamelessly ourselves, to be patient and forgiving, to respect all people, to argue for what is right, but to not give in to the fleshly desire for power and self-promotion, so that in the end we can't be charged with that as being the goal of our activities. For example, you know, and I'll get into the weeds here, but, you know, they're the big issues for Christians, something like abortion. I am firmly convinced that abortion is a great evil and we need to speak out against it. But to a certain extent, we've lost the power to be heard because in the process we are rightly perceived to a certain extent as being self-righteous and power-hungry. We should speak out clearly. But some of the best things that we have done are things like showing respect and compassion to pregnant girls. The more we can make it clear that we are not about our power, our success, our superiority to everyone else, the easier it will be for the world to see what the real issues are, and the easier for the world to reject us when they see what the real issues are, if that's what they want. Their response still might be contempt, but at least we have reflected what the people of God are about in a way that they will either ultimately respond to it as yes, that there's something to that, or else they will reject it, and in rejecting it will have at least known what they're rejecting. That's what I think that Peter's getting at, and I don't know if that makes sense or not, but that's how I would put together the picture that he's painting there. Let me stop there and give us a little time for any questions or comments you have. You must have a comment or something about this, right?
Thanks, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
The last part of your talk there brings to mind a Seinfeld episode where George goes into this Italian, I think it's an Italian restaurant or whatever. he pays for his pizza or calzone or whatever, and then he starts to put a tip in the jar, and the guy ducks down behind the counter and doesn't see him put the tip in the jar. And he's like, he didn't see me put the tip in the jar. Like, the tip's worth nothing then. If they don't see it, put it in, then why did I even tip?
Uh-huh.
So then
uh-huh.
Goes in the next time and he's like waving the dollar around, and I've got a big tip for, and of course he ducks down behind the counter again. And so he goes back behind the into the kitchen, so he's like looking around and wants to take the dollar out to put it back in, so he can see him doing it, you know. And
uh-huh.
Of course the guy catches him and kicks
taking
him out.
That, right.
But I was trying to, you know. And I just, you know, that's kind of the way I respond to this, you know, verse 12, where, you know, I find some Christians kind of, you know, encouraging people to, you know, go out and do good deeds because that can help save somebody.
Right.
Or, you know, don't, do this bad thing because that could cause somebody to not come to church. Or so that you like the primary motivation for everything, for doing a good thing or not doing a bad thing, is the effect it could have on a believer, rather than it's just good for me to do this thing, you know, it's better for me not to do this thing. And how do you separate those?
Well,
as a biblical mandate, you know, sometimes it doesn't seem like it's the
right
what he's getting at.
Right. Well, that's the classic struggle. I mean, we are called to two things that are, I mean, the gap between them is small. It's like with everything else. There's this place. We have Jesus teaching, you know, warning us not to be like the Pharisees who have the trumpets play before they give alms. You know, the idea being that I'm going to be seen as being virtuous. And he says they had their reward in full. And what he means by that is he's saying they weren't really doing it because they thought that helping this person was the right thing to do and what God would want them to do. They're doing it because they get to be seen by everybody else as being righteous, and they really like everybody thinking that they're righteous. So yeah, this kind of exhortation could easily, I mean, like everything else, it could easily become a way of ceasing to be truly interested in what's good and once again being focused on, I'm going to go out there and show everybody how great I am so that I'll bring people into the kingdom. Which is, that can be, I mean, we all have had experience with that kind of thing where it's not really all that attractive even. It doesn't really work in the long run because it just seems like people are putting on this thing so that they can manipulate me into liking them, and they equate liking them with liking God, and so, you know, the whole thing just kind of reeks. But yet, on the other hand, Jesus taught this sort of thing to, you know, don't hide your light under a bushel, you know, let your good works be seen by men so they might glorify your God who's in heaven. Peter's saying a very similar thing sort here. And we're often encouraged to think about the impact of our actions on other people. That is, it is loving to, I mean, in a practical way, we can think about that in relationships. If I know that acting in a certain way is going to be interpreted by my wife as disrespect or unloving or something like that, then I'm not going to do that thing because I understand what I'm communicating when I do it. And that's not hypocrisy. That is genuine love. But the key is what the Bible's really concerned about is that I not be so concerned about my rights or my what I want out of the situation, but that I'm going to conduct myself in such a way that I'm interested in the impact that it's going to have on the other person. That's what loving your enemy is all about. And Jesus' teaching, I think, is that ultimately, if you're compelled to go 1 mile, go two. And the idea is that ultimately I'm communicating. If I'm a hypocrite, so be it. But hopefully I'm not a hypocrite. That, you know, I went the first mile because you told me to. I went the second mile because I wanted to. And then that gets the person thinking, well, why would he do that? Okay, so we're called upon to think about the impact of our actions, I think, but we're not called upon to manipulate people into liking us by putting on shows of goodness. And there's all the difference in the world between those two things, in a sense, and yet sometimes it's hard to tell which of those is true. But I'm with you. I mean, the thing that you're identifying as something that doesn't seem very good, I agree. And the Bible condemns it as well. But that doesn't mean that what I'm being called upon to do is think about the other guy, really, is what I'm being called upon to do. It's not just about me. I have to think about other people in this. And it's as simple as that. Loving is love your neighbor as yourself. It's not just what I get out of it, but what's going to affect them. And that, I think that's what Peter's calling us to.
And this is just one small manifestation of that, of the desire to want to do the right thing.
And to
think of others. This is just one angle at getting at.
Right.
It seems like we blow it way out of proportion sometimes.
Christian
experience, our faith is defined by how well do we represent God to non-Christians.
Right, because we take one thing and highlight it at the expense of other things, and then infuse it with our own self-centeredness in the process. Yeah. Remember, for Peter, that he's talking to people who are suffering in the culture in which they find themselves, and the question is, how are they going to respond? How they respond to the government is part of that, because some of their suffering is coming from there. And so he's really saying to them, I want you to think more about more than just how this is affecting you. I want you to think about how this is affecting even those people who are causing you grief, which we're going to see clearly in the next two examples, the servant who is being mistreated and the wife who is married to an unbeliever who is not treating her well either. And the question is, how are you going to respond? And I'll tell you right now the answer is, think about them. Be concerned for the impact of your choices on them. And that's what he's getting at through this whole thing. Okay, so go ahead.
Another angle that I'm just, I don't think it comes right out of the scripture, but out of your explanation as one reason why Christians can be so seeking the righteousness in public is the sense out of this enjoyment of the power, or the sense that, that gives them security. A place where I struggle with this Christians in the public is also, I think I see a lot of sense of, I think there's a genuine fear as Christians look at society or one's country or whatever country, there's a fear that things are going to pot, and I think in many cases it's extremely genuine and sometimes justified. And I think there's a sense of sometimes participating in politics because there's a sense of we need to have control. Not we want it to feel secure, but if we don't have the power, then bad decisions are going to be made.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is out of a genuine concern for the other. And so I get confused there. Sometimes I just think God's not interested in whether we have the power or not, or whether we have more votes in Congress or not. Partly I think we as Christians disagree on things. And so
yes.
I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot involved with that. I know that there are differences of political persuasion amongst us here in this room. So the odds are good that either you thought several years ago the country was really going to pot, or right now you think that the country is really going to pot, depending on how. And of course, there's always that possibility that, you're an independent or something and you've thought it's been going to pot all along. I don't know. But See, I think what we have to sort out is our fears. I have fears. I don't want to make political comments, but you can understand that I might have fears about my retirement. I might have fears about the world that my children are going to be living in. Those are fears based on, that sense of lack of security. things are going to be hard. I may suffer if the ideas that I think ought to prevail don't prevail. But that's where I think ultimately we're called upon to step back with perspective. God was taking these people through great suffering at the hands of their government, if I understand the situation that Peter is writing to. And it's not necessarily the case that that was going to change, that God, in fact, found that valuable. And, you know, going through the fire is sometimes the best thing to do. And I have to wrestle myself with that. All parents wrestle with this thing that, on the one hand, I have a deep, deep desire to make life good for my children. It's one of the strongest feelings that I have as a parent, is if I could do something to make life good for my children, I would do it. I mean, and I'm not saying that doesn't make me particularly virtuous. I think this is just what parents, that's what they feel. And I have, so... And yet, at the same time, I recognize that most of the most important and valuable things that have happened to me in life have come my way through suffering. So I want to make everything perfect for my children, and yet God thinks that suffering often is the greatest teacher and brings the most wisdom and reward in this life. So I have to back off and say, okay, both for myself and for my children, I have to take the bigger view. God is God, whether the economy of the United States goes down the toilet or not. And so that's part of how I have to look at this stuff. So I'm just really convinced that we as believers are called to be less goal-oriented and more principle-oriented, that it is better for us to be humble, to be compassionate, to speak the truth in a way that reflects God in an appropriate way, and let the chips fall where they may. So the temptation for us is to take shortcuts to get to the power where we can make things the way we would like them to be. And that's the thing that we need to stay away from. I don't know if that speaks to your question or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that. So you're suggesting, if I can echo back, you're suggesting, for example, that in the field of politics, which is drawn out by this question of how do we relate to government,
right. What
would be, regardless of the position that we hold for whatever reasons, our goal in speaking out or even participating in the political realm should be not necessarily to get the block of votes for X point of view, but let's say person A and person B are two Christians that stand on different sides of a particular issue, both of their goals should be to speak honestly with humility and to work for perhaps what they think is right, but not ultimately to necessarily get the biggest voting block.
Yeah. And, you know, this is where I'm probably way in over my head, but it seems to me, I mean, I've heard people say, and this really seems to be true to me, that we have to think, you can't legislate from the top what a people are not prepared to live out. So if I was to manage to grab this little Christian voting block and manage to get in and say, okay, now you got to do it my way, in the end, what is that really going to mean? It means that there's a whole bunch of people who are going to feel like the enemy won and imposed his stuff on me, and as soon as they can, they're going to get out from under it. And in the end, what did that really accomplish? I think we do better to try to influence from within our culture, to say, look, to call us to, isn't this what life ought to be? In such a way that then, you know, the politics will follow the people, because the people are not going to follow the politics, I don't think. So that's my opinion.
No, thank you.
Don't listen to me about politics.
No, thank you. That's very helpful.
Anybody else? No, nobody else. Okay, thanks.